Today on Against the Grain, is the white working class a group of bigots? They're the backbone of Donald Trump's support, we're told by the mainstream media, although it's not clear if that's actually true. Within the left, as well as the mainstream, there frequently is an assumption that white workers, particularly provincial white workers, are almost inherently reactionary, and that country music is the soundtrack to that bigotry. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll be joined by scholar Nadine Hubbs to talk about rednecks, queers, and country music. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. What's the matter with the white working class? That question has been asked by liberals and progressives alike, bemoaning the reactionary politics of often provincial blue-collar whites. As the argument goes, the redneck culture, frequently expressed in country music, is imbued with bigotry against women, people of color, and queers. But scholar Nadine Hubbs asserts that the assumption that the white working class is a group of bigots is both wrong and ahistorical, and plays a role in maintaining the social order and the position of middle-class people within it. She's professor of women's studies and music at the University of Michigan. In her book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, published by the University of California Press, she makes the argument that working-class whites used to be seen as deviant for being too tolerant of homosexuality, and now are seen as deviant for not being tolerant enough. Nadine, can you begin by contrasting for us the conventional wisdom about the social attitudes of metropolitan middle-class whites with those of the white working class?
According to the conventional wisdom, the white working class is America's bigot class. And in my work, I trace that history back particularly to the 70s. It's not that it's a totally new idea. It's been quite a long time that the middle class has regarded the working class, the white working class particularly, in terms of sexism, homophobia, racism, even when those went under other names. But it's been since the civil rights era and the great social changes that followed, according to my argument, that working class people have especially been portrayed as the bigot class, because it's become so much more important not to be a bigot. Today, having tolerant, if you will, social politics is it's a crucial form of cultural capital in American society. To be seen as a bigot is to have less power in most of the spheres of power that matter to us. So I look in my work especially at sexuality. And the conventional wisdom today is that homophobia comes from the working class. And at times, as you know, in California, that's been pointed at African American and Latinx communities, as it was after Prop 8, when there were a lot of reports that Prop 8 banning same-sex marriage was passed by churchgoers, African-American and Latinx. It was pretty quickly disproved, but more often it's the white working class that gets that kind of finger pointed at them. And when it comes to homophobia, what I show in Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music is that the sin of the working class for 100 years, historians of LGBTQ life tend to know very well that it was around 1870 in Europe that the homosexual was born, was invented by medicine and psychology. And the first 100 years of that identity, that homo-hetero regime, found fault with the working class as queer lovers. What was proof that working class people were more primitive, less moral, and degenerate and pathological was that they did not rebuff the advances of queer people, that it was their neighborhoods that were the sites of much and most queer activity, sexual and social. And that went up in my argument till the 70s. So it shows remarkable cultural amnesia that now we've had for only some 40 years a complete reversal in our view of the working class. They are now primitive and degenerate and pathological as queer haters. And yet we not only don't question that history, but we've pretty much completely forgot about that prior 100 years. And moreover, we project our current views backward and imagine that things have always been like this throughout history.
So working class people were seen as deviant then. They're seen as deviant now because they are seen as inherently bigoted. But one of the things that you do is you separate out working class attitudes from those that are projected onto them by elites, and especially the middle class as a sort of class producing cultural assumptions that then get disseminated widely, whether it's through academia or the media or whatever. So just to be clear, are you saying that in the long stretch of the past century, the majority of it, when working class people were seen as deviant and sexually suspect, is that simply the projection of middle class people onto them, or were working class people, and in this case, white working class people, more accepting of queerness in their midst?
Historians, including George Chauncey, historians of LGBTQ life in the 20th century, have shown that indeed that was the reality, that it was in working class neighborhoods and the neighborhoods of socially marginalized people. So Harlem, for example, was the place to go for queer nightlife in the earlier 20th century for elites as well as some regular folk. In that case, it was the racial margins, but it was also in waterfront neighborhoods, working class neighborhoods, that gay bars, sex clubs, and even gay residential neighborhoods, and as other historians have shown, the highly visible forms of queer life, such as butch femme lesbian couples and pansies or fairies among gay men, those visible forms of queer life were also located in working class areas. And so indeed, as Chauncey said, it was known among men who had sex with men in gay New York in the early 20th century that if a man made a sexual advance to a working class man, the risk of being severely rebuffed was not as great. It was in the middle class that people in the 20th century started to become self-conscious and deliberate about not appearing to be homosexual.
So what changed in terms of this shift that you've described, that working class people and white working class people were seen as deviant because they were seen as too tolerant, too queer themselves, too embedded in queer or gay life? And then starting, you date it to the 50s, but in full-fledged in the 70s, there was a shift, a larger societal shift, the rise of movements of gay liberation and a turn at least amongst the middle classes, towards more tolerance of gayness or queerness. Why then did that translate into seeing working class people as being bigoted in terms of sexuality, forgetting that prior history? What happened then?
So that's an excellent question. And I am working on that question now. I have three possibilities in mind. One is that the idea that the working class became homophobic after the civil rights era, when the middle class attitudes shifted and saw tolerance as the social ideal. So the first possibility is that it's a figment of the middle class imagination, that the working class did not become more homophobic, but since the middle class constitutes what I call the narrating class, and it's people like us, so-called experts from journalism or academe, who get to tell folks stories, the middle class started to tell the story of the working class in terms of homophobic bigotry. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that the working class was more hostile, not to the queer itself, but rather to the new middle class branding of the queer. The middle class came to stamp queerness, property of the middle class in this period. It's a shift that I call the middle classing of the queer. After in the 70s and after. And so once that happened, because of the antagonism between the working class and the middle class, it's quite possible that the working class held at arm's length all the new forms and language and labels and classifications. And it's also important to recognize it's not simply that the middle class took over the language and replaced older labels with new labels, but they had whole new lines that they drew. The working class understandings of queerness were different. Grassroots understandings of queer life and queer classification were different from the ones that we accept now officially in the middle class. So, for example, it's not only the category of transgender, which has been with us for maybe 20 years at most, which many of us will remember in our own lifetimes as being more recent. But the way things were sliced and diced were different in the working class. But once the middle class had branded itself as tolerant, they sort of owned the queer in a way. And it's quite possible that the working class rejected those classifications and those labels and were seen then mistakenly to reject the queer overall, the queer per se. And then one other possibility is that the working class actually did become more homophobic and do kind of a 180 after the civil rights era in the 70s and since. And who knows why that would have happened. One could hypothesize that if, in fact, the working class went from being queer lovers to queer haters, perhaps it was because they believed the stereotype that started to circulate about them. But I'm not sure that that happened, or if it did, how it happened. I guess there's a fourth possibility, too, and that would be that some combination of these things happened.
That is the voice of Nadine Hubbs. She's the author of Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music. That's published by the University of California Press. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, staying with one of the possibilities that you raised, this notion that there was a backlash to the changes, the social upheaval of the 60s, that led the white working class to become more homophobic. That goes with an argument that often gets made about the white working class, and the rise of the right in the 60s and the 70s, that there was a societal shift that took place that either entrenched deeply held notions of racial or sexual prejudice, or allowed those notions to take on maybe a more overt form. This is a broader question than you focus on in your book, but I'm raising it because it seems to be an issue that comes up and again when people, progressives in particular, talk about the white working class with What's the Matter with Kansas, Thomas Frank's book maybe being one of the better known, an assumption that there has been a sort of sea change with the white working class toward reactionary politics. Would you say that that's unfair?
I would say that it's unfair to this extent. We have unfairness on a daily basis in our discourse, our political discourse, our national discourse. We talk about the working class and rarely hear the voices of the working class, at least in the sort of framework in which the narrating class gets to operate. So sure, we see working class people at their angriest, sputtering or swearing or, you know, displaying the kinds of attitudes for which the working class is held in contempt. One of the reasons in my book I wanted to use country music is not that I assume that country music is an unmediated, crystal clear representation of universal working class feeling, but at least I think by having not only expert discourses on the working class in my book, when I cite research by anthropologists and sociologists, but also country music. I mean, let's leave aside the question of whether all the artists come from the American working class. Nevertheless, these are songs that a lot of working class people and middle class listeners as well embrace as statements that resonate with their own experience. So it's difficult to get working class discourses about working class experience. And because country music is so beloved and such a powerful discourse for many working class listeners, I wanted to have that discourse in there. So yeah, I've been talking about how the form of our discourse is unfair. And then you were asking me also, I think, about whether I think that assessment of working class backlash post-1960s, whether that was unfair, an unfair assessment. I think that my work also shows that there is unfairness in that assessment. Many country songs since the 1950s have expressed sentiments that country scholars have termed hillbilly humanism. So outsiders to country music hear country as bigoted, and they assume that it's racist, they assume it's sexist and homophobic. And my systematic and thorough examination of country music throughout this book never turns up instances of those forms of bigotry. It does turn up more instances of narrating class commentators making those accusations. But what does come up time and again in country music is the hillbilly humanist message that says simply, none of us is better than another, and none of us should judge anyone else. Which is really, really simple, and yet it comes up time and again, hundreds of times throughout country songs. There are also angrier country music expressions, often in what we call hard country music, where resentment and anger toward the middle class is clear and in technicolor for all to hear. And I talk in depth about a couple of those songs in the book. One of them is Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman. The other that I talk about in great depth is David Allan Coe's underground track, F. Anita Bryant, to edit the title for radio.
Right, and we will talk more about that latter song as the program goes on, but tell us about the song, which was a hit in 2004 by Gretchen Wilson, Redneck Woman. And what does it tell us about both the sort of self-identity of working class women within country music and also how the white working class straight women are seen, in effect, from above?
Mm-hmm. Redneck Woman was a huge hit. It was a mega hit. It was a record-breaking hit in 2004. And fans responded enormously to this song. It is a song that is thumbing its nose at middle-class expectations that are imposed on people like the redneck woman. And in that song, she constructs her identity. She proclaims her identity as a redneck woman. And in part, she does it by saying what she is not. And she makes it clear that she doesn't wish that she were a middle-class woman. She's rural. She states, "You might think I'm trashy, a little too hardcore, but in my neck of the woods, I'm just the girl next door." So I think she's fending off the sexual disrepute that is imposed on working class women, and we have plenty of empirical research that shows that that indeed is still the case. We assume sluttiness on the part of working class women. We hold them more responsible, for example, when they're sexually assaulted. It must have been her fault. Redneck Woman knows that. She's anticipating the critique, and she's singing against it. And I think it's a brilliant song. She arrays herself with her allies, and they are, for the most part, country and hard rock male artists. It is, at the same time, a feminist statement. I think what she does by that move is block the breakup, anyone dividing and conquering within the working class. She makes her alliance with working class men so that it clarifies all the more that her complaint, though it's a feminist complaint, is against the bourgeoisie.
Well, let's take a listen to that song. This is Redneck Woman by Gretchen Wilson.
From the redneck girls like me. Hell yeah!
Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about the presumption of bigotry amongst the white working class, especially as it relates to homophobia, and about country music as the soundtrack of that bigotry. I'm speaking with Nadine Hubbs. She's professor of women's studies and music at the University of Michigan, the author of The Queer Composition of America's Sound, and Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, which is published by the University of California Press, and which we have a link to on our website, againstthegrain.org. So I want to ask you a lot more about country music, which is the third pillar of your book, but I also wanted to continue the discussion of a kind of knee-jerk assumption that white working class people, as expressed in country music often, but not only, are bigoted, and that the culture of the white working class, especially the provincial white working class, is a bigoted one. Your book focuses on gender and sexuality, and you were just talking about that as it relates to Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman. But I did want to ask you about race. Just the term redneck for many people immediately conjures up an assumption of white supremacy, the image of the Confederate flag, and so on. This idea of owning the term redneck. And I wanted to ask you about how the cultural assumptions about white working class people as they relate to race, how talking about racism within the white working class, which undoubtedly is real, that looking at that without looking at the broader class structure takes white elites off the hook.
Right. So undoubtedly, racism is real. And it's real in the working class. It's real in the middle class. It's real among elites. So I think that is an extremely important point to observe. And I often say when I'm talking about this work, I'm hoping to make some modest proposals. One is simply that there is no singular bigot class in America. There's bigotry across society in multiple forms and in every class. My modest proposal number two is that the working class does not all share a brain. There is diversity among working class people. diversity of political views, of social politics, all the same kinds of diversity you would expect to find in other sectors of American society. And we rarely get that in representations of the white working class.
Well, and taking it further, you focus in the book about how white metropolitan elites cast out the white working class as this homogeneous group of bigots. To what degree does that actually serve those in power when the social structures that may be racist and sexist themselves are less questioned than just a certain population?
That's right. As I said earlier, having a tolerant social politics is today a form of cultural capital. And at the most basic level, every middle-class individual bases their identity and the privilege of their middle-class status on, first and foremost, not being working class. So there's a built-in antagonism. And to view the working class as bigoted allows us in the middle class to define ourselves by contrast and to benefit from the capital that tolerant identity affords in contemporary society.
So yes, in your book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, you look at the working class not in some isolation or just in frozen in the aspect of the present, but that you're seeing the white working class in historical perspective, but also in a kind of, for lack of a better word, relational perspective, that how the middle class sees the working class is very, very relevant because, as you just said, the self-identification of the middle class has everything to do with not being working class. And that's where country music comes in yet again, because you argue that taste is one crucial place for this kind of class self-identity, and distaste, you know, as much so. So can you tell us just about the history of country music for those who really may not know much? While the white middle class generally would disavow country music, as you say, anything but country, there are quite a few white middle class people who listen to bluegrass or Americana, in contrast to the supposedly commercialized country music. Can you just give us a brief overview of country music? Is it fair to contrast an authentic roots music against a top 40 country music, which is the latter being the focus of your work here?
Yeah, authenticity you raise, that's a key question. And to try to cut a long story short, both bluegrass and country have commercial histories, and they both came up as commercial musics. Bluegrass quite a bit more recently, it turns out, than country. It's a post-war musical format, whereas country started in the early part of the 1920s. And the history of the formation of the U.S. music industry is actually crucial here, because one of the signs that outsiders or country haters typically cite, one of the signs of the bigotry and the racism of country music, is its whiteness. There have been African-American and Latinx artists in country, but it's a majority white music. And the history of the formation of the music industry back in the 1920s is actually what determined that. In the early 20s, the dawning recording industry went down into the South to scout talent, and they found, even in the Jim Crow era, Southern working class music that was a mishmash and involved both white and black musicians, both of whom were proud to be able to play any song or any style that you might request. So it was music industry executives who determined that, first of all, Southern working class music was separate from the other kinds of music they were recording, middle class music, and then that they would only record African American musicians when they were singing blues, and white working class Southern musicians when they were performing what we would call string band music. And they pretty soon dubbed that hillbilly music, and they had dubbed the other style race records. That is, both of those forms are still very racially specific musical formats to this day. We now know them as country and R&B. So scholar Carl Miller referred to that situation. He narrated that history and called it segregating sound, so that the color line became an audible phenomenon. But that was determined not by contemporary country fans at all. It is a symptom of racism, indeed, but not in the way that many people assume. It's been a symptom of racism ever since the formation and the birth of the commercial music industry. Roots music, Americana, sometimes known as alt country, and its relationship to bluegrass, as I say, a post-war music. Authenticity definitely works differently in those two different musical realms, and it ties in complex ways to the classing of those two realms. There's been a lot of crossover from country charts lately, with not only bro country, but artists like Taylor Swift and Lady Antebellum. But even still, the impulse of middle-class people to declare their tastes by saying, I'll listen to anything but country, that is ongoing. In fact, a recent study within the past 2 years showed that it's stronger than ever, even stronger than it was 20 years ago when it was first documented.
I was interested to read in your book that attitudes of middle-class people toward music, the posture of middle-class people today, in the past, I guess, when high culture and low culture were more polarized, that maybe in the 1940s and 50s you would mark your class status by listening exclusively to classical music. Mm-hmm. That shifted as those sort of larger societal shifts that you've described coming out of the 60s, the 70s. People now, urbane, sophisticated white middle-class people, have very broad musical tastes, and so they listen to, you know, music from around the world, and it's a wide net in contrast, supposedly, to the narrowness of country music. But it was interesting, I was interested to read that even so, despite that breadth of musical taste that is a marker of middle-class class status, that there are some musics that are distinct from that. They're not included in that umbrella, and country music's one, but also heavy metal and gospel, musics that are of particular underclasses.
Yes, a famous sociological study showed in the 90s that the so-called cultural omnivore, who demonstrates their mastery of global culture by inclusion rather than exclusion, still draws the line. There are limits to omnivore inclusion, and country, heavy metal, and gospel are among the styles of music that are excluded. And according to this famous study, when they're excluded, it's not just a question of musical exclusion. It links to social exclusion. It links to exclusion of the social group associated with those musics, and all of the groups are known as the least educated groups in society.
Nadine Hubbs is my guest. She's professor of women's studies and music at the University of Michigan. We're discussing her book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, that's published by the University of California Press. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I wanted to turn to a song that you mentioned earlier in the program, which really cuts against the notion, the received wisdom that many people, certainly middle-class people, have about country music and the politics of country music. And that is a song that was released in 1978 called, and this is, of course, the expurgated version, F. Anita Bryant, written by David Allen Coe, and was written against the singer and Orange Juice spokeswoman who led the so-called Save Our Children campaign against gay rights in Florida. Before talking about the song, can you just tell listeners who David Allen Coe is?
David Allen Coe may not be as much of a household name as, say, Johnny Cash or Loretta Lynn, but was a well-known star in 1970s and 1980s country music, and he still tours today. He was a member of the outlaw country movement in the 70s, which included Willie Nelson and a lot of other mostly male artists of that time, and it was definitely a hard country group. David Allen Coe is an ex-convict, and in this song, which was released only on an underground album, which in 1978, just months after Anita Bryant first reared her head as an anti-gay crusader, and by the way, historians today regard her campaign as more consequential than Stonewall in 1969 was, because her anti-gay campaign really galvanized the LGBT movement, and they organized and became much more effective in order to fight her campaign, which had started out with a great deal of effectiveness. David Allen Coe is singing in a way that really can jam the circuitry of middle-class listening. He is using the language he knew as an incarcerated man in an all-male environment. And so he's not doing as Anita Bryant herself had done, which was always to use the polite middle-class term for homosexual. That's the only word I think she used. I don't think she would even use the word gay. He didn't use the word gay. He used the word faggot. He used the word queer back before that had been a reclaimed word. And he is singing both against Anita Bryant and, I argue, against middle-class propriety. It's one of those anti-bourgeois country songs in spades.
We can't air the song itself because it has profanity in it, but can you give us a sense of the lyrics of the song?
Yeah. David Allen Coe is basically telling Anita Bryant to go to hell because he knows that those people she calls homosexuals have a lot to offer. And he talks about how they'll share their cocaine with you. And they will at times clean your clock and at other times make you feel really good. So he doesn't hold them at savage distance. It's a fascinating historical sort of time capsule, this song. And I argue that we no longer tend to have the tools to read the song in its original meaning. But David Allen Coe was one of the few people who was striking back at Anita Bryant so soon. And one of the things that is significant about that song is how it shows this outlaw country singer, ex-con, disreputable character who always claimed his title as a redneck, a white trash person, and of course that's hate speech, I'm saying it in quotes, and as someone on the margins of society. And I read this song as a statement of a kind of coalitional, marginal politics. And one of the problems I see with the narrating class getting to tell everyone's story, including the stories of the working class, who are both their class rivals and unknown to them as we get more and more stratified in American society, we fail to appreciate how David Allan Coe and other country artists of that period were really expressing a coalitional politics of the margins, across class lines, across sexual lines, among working class people of various sorts. Largely, I suppose, the stifling of that message has to do with a lack of competency in the working class codes.
Well, let me ask you more about politics and the kind of broader implications. Through this hour, you've touched on the significance of seeing the white working class as, in your words, a permanent bigot class, as a population that has deeply entrenched sort of ahistorical beliefs that don't change, that are reactionary. And you have been arguing that, in fact, if you take the longer view, that you can see that the white working class has been seen as, in turns, too tolerant of homosexuality and too intolerant of homosexuality, depending on the time. And this is something that the politics of the white working class and why they take the stance that they do politically has been a source of a lot of head scratching amongst progressives. And particularly of late with this election cycle, it's been a focus of attention. Although it should be said that support for Donald Trump by the working class whites actually appears to be overstated. Clearly, he does have some white working class support, but his supporters seem to be more likely to be from the white middle class, although this doesn't seem to make it into much of the reports about that. But anyway, that is the sort of received wisdom, that he has that support. And clearly, white working class people have supported the right at various times, and which may seem baffling given the class interests that get served. I wanted to end by asking you, do you think that part of the problem, now not talking about the white middle class in general, but talking about the left specifically, which is much of it is made up of middle class people, do you think that middle class leftists or progressives have added to this problem in terms of the way that the white working class is seen and the assumptions that are made about the potential or lack thereof for what you described as coalitional politics?
I do. I listened to some of the country songs from the 1970s, including F. Anita Bryant, and I'm reminded of the call for a big tent coalitionalism in one of the most famous scholarly LGBT articles, Kathy Cohen's Punks, Bulldaggers, and Welfare Queens from 1997. And she's calling out for queer activists and scholars to realize the full potential of queer politics, which in the original dream had been a coalitional possibility, that we're not just splitting hairs according to identity politics, but rather organizing around queer in the sense of opposition to the normal. And hence her title, Punks, Bulldaggers, and Welfare Queens, you know, bringing together these differently sexually disreputable people, all of whom are marginalized. I hear that sort of thing in some of this music, a very unexpected place for, I think, many of my colleagues in the academic privileged left. I think that we know by now that there's always a problem when we have any group in society who is not speaking for itself. And if we look at the politics of representation when it comes to the white working class in this country, you know, the only time I hear or see white working class people speaking for themselves is when they're representing the perspectives that match with our stereotypes of the white working class as reactionary and as the bigot class.
You mean that's when they get the TV cameras?
Exactly, exactly. But when we think about the fact that the working class, not the middle class, is still the majority in the United States, then as you noted just a moment ago, we have to question whether, in fact, the white working class is disproportionately backing Donald Trump. There have been data that have indicated, at least earlier this year, that that was not the case. We're treating the working class and our representations and our discourses about the working class as a very specific population. But even today, no matter whether you get the 53% estimate or the 62% estimate, it still suggests that the working class is the majority. And so that means that rather than talking about, oh, Trump supporters as working class Americans, in some sense, if the majority of his support is coming from working class people, then what we're talking about is average Americans are the support for Trump. And that puts a different spin on things. The middle class, people in my tribe, well, we know that we're more secluded by now and isolated, and we have more distance from regular folk than we have in the past. We're living in neighborhoods among our own kind. We're marrying into people who have the same sort of educations and incomes that we have to a much greater degree than had happened in the past. To speak of the working class then in such an othering way is already distortive. Rather than talking about sort of majority Americans, average Americans, if that makes any sense.
Indeed it does. And I've been speaking with Nadine Hubbs. She is the author of Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music. That's published by the University of California Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's professor of women's studies and music at the University of Michigan, also the author of The Queer Composition of America's Sound. Nadine, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sasha. It's been such a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.